And we'd leave the site and watch the news at night, and you'd see all these photos from all the other sites. Our colleagues would ask, well, how come we're not getting attention? It's like, because we're not at a place they can see us all the time. But we were the ones who were actually recovering things important to the investigation. People were a little hurt by the fact that we weren't getting the same attention because we didn't have the great loss of life that you had in the World Trade Center or the Pentagon.
Even as the U.S. launched a war in Afghanistan aimed at destroying Al-Qaeda, the terror group responsible for the attack, in October 2001, the victims, co-workers, and family members affected by the attack tried to bring a sense of normalcy back to their lives, though returning to normal often required a redefinition of normal.
Rosemary Dillard. Eddie loved history. And when I was offered the job here in Washington, he was so excited because of the history, the things we were going to get to see, the changing of the leaves. We moved here in February 2001. He didn't get to see the changing of the leaves.
Harry Weiser, Tax Counsel, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 104th floor, was burned over 35% of his body. It was many weeks before they were confident that I would survive. I woke up slowly. I found out about 9/11 by asking questions. The first thing I asked was, what happened that day? My wife, Karen, told me that a plane flew into the World Trade Center. I asked, was it terrorists? She said yes. I asked how many died, and she said 5,000, which was the number they thought at the time. I then started going through names, and I think that was almost as hard for her as it was for me.
Monica O'Leary, former employee, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. Dave Cravette called, and I didn't know he was alive. He said, when are you coming back? We want you back. I was like, I don't know when I can come back. He said, well, as soon as you're ready to come back, you've got a space here. Oddly enough, because I was laid off in the afternoon on September 10th, and because the Human Resources Department all died, I was never taken off the payroll. I went back to work again. It's not like they had to rehire me. I was never gone.
Stephen Larrabee, Cantor Fitzgerald, L.A. office, whose son, Christopher, died in Cantor's New York office. It was hard coming back. There are a lot of ghosts there.
Charles Kristoff, attorney, Broadway. Gretchen was, at that time, 11 months old. She didn't speak very much. Her behavior changed because I was the only one picking her up, taking care of her, feeding her. Usually, Kirsten took care of her in the evening, bathing her, feeding her, putting her in the bath. She stopped talking. It was quiet most of the time. She had this sense that her mom was not there. For a couple of weeks, after an exhaustive search, I could not find her. I called Kirsten's family, and we decided to have a memorial service, even though we didn't have a body. We had the memorial service at the end of September. It was September 30th. Over 400 people came. Family members, friends, neighbors, Kirsten's college friends. So many people came, the church could not accommodate everyone. It was very sad. You have only a portrait and flowers. We did the memorial service, and a week or two thereafter, two policemen came to my house and told me that they found the body. I was a single father, taking care of my daughter. I missed Kirsten very much.
Months. As part of a series of new air transportation security laws passed after the attacks, the U.S. government established the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund to help families who lost loved ones in the attacks. Washington lawyer Ken Feinberg was appointed in November to oversee the process and mediate how much each victim's family would receive. As Feinberg said later, I underestimated the emotion of this at the beginning. He worked for 33 months, pro bono, to distribute over $7 billion from the U.S. Treasury. The average family received $1.8 million.
Kenneth Feinberg, Special Master. September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. I stated over and over again publicly on television and the radio, anybody who voluntarily wants to come and see me privately, I will see them. I remember my first meeting like it was yesterday. A 24-year-old woman came to see me, sobbing. Mr. Feinberg, my husband died in the World Trade Center. He was a fireman. And he left me with our two children, 6 and 4. Now, I've applied to the fund, and you have calculated that I'm going to get $2.8 million tax-free. I want it in 30 days. I said, why do you need the money in 30 days? She said, why 30 days? I have terminal cancer. I have 10 weeks to live. My husband was going to survive me and take care of our two children. Now they're going to be orphans. I've got to get this money while I still have my faculties. I've got to set up a trust. I've got to find a guardian. We never anticipated this. I ran down to the treasury. We accelerated the processing of her claim. We got her the money, and 8 weeks later, she died. You think you're ready for anything, and you're not.
Richard Grasso, Chairman and CEO, New York Stock Exchange. For the balance of that year, no one rang either the opening or closing bell other than a first responder that we would get from Ground Zero, a firefighter or police officer, an EMS person, a Port Authority police officer, visiting firemen from around the country, visiting police officers, the ironworkers. All of the tradespeople who were there were welcomed, not to ring that bell as a symbol of what was going on, but to ring that bell again, reiterating the message of America rising. It was always an extraordinary moment because whether it was an opening bell or a closing bell, whichever of the uniformed services or the trades would first come and walk across the trading floor, and they'd get a hero's welcome.
Lieutenant Joseph Turillo, the action figure, Billy Blazes, became the biggest selling toy of the year. Because of September 11th, it became a collector's item.
Dan Potter, we moved out of Battery Park in December of 2001 because you could hear the equipment working and the recovery process going on. It was very debilitating for Jean. She was very, very upset. It was heart-wrenching to see broken buildings, people with devastated lives. People that lived around us had perished. You see the steel down the street. It was a very hard time.
Detective David Brink, there was one evening. It was a cold December evening, probably around 6:30 at night, and nobody had gotten down there yet. They were getting their assignments. We were standing there, and my partner for the day had to go and use the facilities. I was standing down there, and I felt like I was the only living soul in the entire Trade Center site, out of all the acreage there. There wasn't a sound at all. All the equipment had come to a stop. There was nobody talking. It seemed like there was nobody down there except myself, but I was there with all these people's souls. There were almost 3,000 people waiting to be found, saying, please, come find me.
Vanessa Lawrence. Afterwards, I went through mixed feelings. I got to the point that I had to leave New York. I couldn't actually handle it anymore. There were too many things freaking me out. Sounds, smells, anything.
Pasquale Bazzelli, engineer, Port Authority, North Tower, 64th floor. I was almost in this trance, watching, hearing the news, waiting by the phone to hear if they found someone. I would lay there on the couch, eating and watching TV. I started to grow a little bit angry, thinking every day, wow, there are people out there that basically tried to kill me, and they succeeded in killing my friends. My daughter was born on November 18th, and that was a relief at the time. It was a break. But time went on, and I started to distance myself somehow. I remember not being able to sleep at night, getting nightmares. You would fight this battle inside of you, and you say, hey, asshole, you're alive. You should be happy. Then you're happy for a second, and you say to yourself, hey, asshole, you're happy, and someone else is dead. You're happy you're alive. What does that say about you? then you don't feel happy.
Louise Bazzelli. There was no escaping it. You'd say, my God, he's so lucky. Look what he survived. But he didn't feel like he was lucky. He felt guilty. He felt like, I don't want people to look at me and think, you're so lucky, you're the luckiest man in the world. What are you going to do now? God has a plan for you. For years, he couldn't figure out what that plan was. He said, I don't know what the plan is, but I'm going to be the best husband, father, dad, son that I can be. That's how I'm going to live my life.
Frank Rosano, in the weeks afterwards, I tried to find out who the fireman was who had gotten me out of the building. About 9 months later, my nephew called me up and said, Uncle Frank, I was on my way into work reading the New York Post, and there is a story in there about a fireman who won the Liberty Medal for saving the lives of 3 middle-aged men. It sounds like your story. It identified the fireman as Jeff Johnson. I wrote Jeff a letter asking, are you the fireman who got me out? 3 days later, his wife, Ro, called my wife, Stephanie, and gave her the telephone number at the ladder company. I called and made contact with Jeff. The first words out of his mouth were, I'm very sorry for that article that appeared in the Post. I said, well, what are you sorry about? He said, it made me sound like I was James Bond. I said, Jeff, you have to understand something. To me, you're a hero. You got me out of that building. I would still be on the third floor landing, scratching my head, figuring out what to do, how to get out.
Years. The trauma, drama, and tragedy of 9/11 forever affected those it touched, altering the course of the country, launching the United States into 2 wars that continue to this day. The children of those who first invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 are now eligible to serve and be deployed to continue fighting the same war more than 17 years later. The significance of the date of September 11th, 9/11, was seared into the nation's collective memory, altering the way those affected looked at the calendar and even clocks. Even those for whom the date was meant to bear happy memories, like Susanna Harada, whose son was born in Arlington amid the injured from the Pentagon, found themselves haunted. Choosing what and how to remember the day remains a complicated challenge, as does charting a life forward day to day, especially for those who suffered from ongoing health challenges related to either the attacks themselves or the cleanup work after. The death toll of 9/11 has continued to steadily rise.
Rosemary Dillard, Washington, D.C., base manager, American Airlines, and wife of Flight 77 passenger Eddie Dillard. I grieved while other people became afraid. I still think that we all walk on eggshells. I don't think that the young people who will be listening to this will know the same freedom I knew growing up.
Susanna Harada, resident Arlington, Virginia, whose son was born on 9/11. The only other thing that we did for his first birthday is that we had all the neighbors over, and we said we want to celebrate the heroes of the day. We had a moment of silence during the party, and we said, let's remember everybody. Every year on his birthday, we take some time.
Jay Johnson, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, 2013 to 2017. My birthday is 9/11. I haven't celebrated on that day since 2001. The memory from 2001 overwhelms the birthday.
Mary Matlin. One of the strange things that didn't occur to me until the first anniversary was how much I didn't know was going on. I did not have the perspective seeing what the American public was seeing. When I watched the coverage on the first anniversary, I couldn't stop crying. I was shocked. We weren't watching TV. We weren't watching people jumping out of buildings. We didn't see all the chaos that the American people were seeing. It frightens me to the core to think what America must have been feeling watching that. We weren't exposed to it.
James Schwartz. I actually assumed the position of president of the PTA the following year, when the one-year anniversary was about to take place. There were a lot of parents in the school that wanted to let the anniversary go by. They didn't want to acknowledge it. It was so horrifying, it will only traumatize the children. They don't need to see these images or be reminded of this. I said, this is a learning opportunity. There is no escaping this. We did what I thought was a very meaningful event that honored the losses, reflected on the impact to the nation, and hopefully taught the kids something about what it means to be an American and what it means to serve others.
Ultimately, the toll of 9/11 has manifested itself in ways far beyond the initial casualty list. In New York, 9/11-related ailments bedevil the first responders, who spent days, weeks, and months cleaning up the wreckage at Ground Zero. All told, more than 7,000 firefighters and EMTs in New York were treated for 9/11-related injuries. New York estimates that 20% of those first responders also suffer from PTSD. The toll was great at the Pentagon as well. Nearly 10% of the Arlington County Fire Department resigned due to post-traumatic stress. First responders, including FBI agents, also struggled with physical illnesses linked to 9/11.
Philip Smith, Branch Chief, U.S. Army, Pentagon. We were all required to take classes at the Pentagon Health Clinic that were called Get Your Life Back. To this day, when people go through trauma, I recommend that they get mental health care. You may not think that you need care, but what you'll learn is that if you don't deal with the stress, the mental stress, professionally, within 5 years, it will manifest itself in a physical ailment.
Captain Mike Smith, Arlington County Fire Department. 9/11 tore through the department like a bowling ball.
Dr. David Prezant, Chief Medical Officer, FDNY. Due to the physical nature of their jobs, these illnesses have had a tremendous impact on our membership and their families. Since 9/11/01, over 2,100 FDNY responders have been awarded service-connected disability due to WTC-related illnesses, mostly respiratory or cancer. The death toll continues to grow. In the years that followed, 203 of the first responders we have been monitoring died, and over half of them have had their deaths attributed to WTC-related illnesses.
Bill Spade, Firefighter Rescue 5, FDNY. My lungs aren't too good. My wife took me to the hospital in January 2003. I was in the hospital again for 3 days. Basically, the doctor said I have World Trade Center lungs. Then I realized it was time. March of 2003, I retired. Everything since 9/11, I counted as one more day on Earth than I ever thought I would have.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross, Engine 16, FDNY. I just got together with the survivors. The other night we had our annual dinner. We called it the Survivors of Stairway B Annual Dinner.
Philip Smith. I truly believe it was a miracle of 9/11 that I survived. So I stayed on active duty in the Army as long as I could. Statutorily, my limit was 30 years. I was able to do almost an extra year as a retiree recall. Today, I work in the same workspace in the Pentagon as a civilian, because every day that I serve, I support my soldiers that were killed, and the terrorists don't win. That means an awful lot to me.
Sharon Miller. I can never understand why I got out. How come I got out, and all these guys who had kids and kids on the way didn't? I remember they had a benefit. I think it was a hockey game or a basketball game afterwards. I had my uniform on. I had Police Academy on the collar. And this guy said to me, "Did you know my dad?" I said, "Well, who's your dad?" He said, "Steve Hushko." I said, "Oh, yes. I did." I said, "I was with your dad on 9/11. The last time I saw him, he was helping a lady who was having trouble breathing. He was really good. He was doing his job.
Oh, wow, that's good. Maybe that's why I got out, so I could tell these kids what their dads were doing, where they were, and how they were helping everybody.
Captain Robert Gray, Technical Rescue, Station 4, Arlington County Fire Department. We still have some people who are really, really hung up on the fact that the Pentagon is in Arlington. Yet every time it's referred to, they say Washington, D.C. It's important to make sure people know that the Pentagon sits in Arlington. It's important to make sure that everybody knows about how Arlington, as a community, responded, how the region responded. I made a decision in 2002 that I wasn't going to let the whole fact that the Memorial Board at the Pentagon says Pentagon and Washington, D.C. under it bother me. Because I find myself, even today, when relatives come in, you know what I ask them? When are you coming to Washington? And they're staying at my house.
Malin Fuller. I go back to the Shanksville site on 9/11 every year. In 2003, I was sitting on one of the benches. There was a woman beside me. I could tell from the ribbon she was wearing she had lost somebody in the crash. I said, "Did you lose someone?" She said, "Yes." All I could say was, "I'm so sorry." She said, "Did you?" I told her that I was a supervisor in the Pittsburgh Control Tower, and I still can't get over this. She said, "How are you?" She asked me that. How am I? What an amazing thing.
Teresa Flynn. Years after, I talk to friends and relatives, and it always comes up. It always comes up. These are people who have been in places with tornadoes and with hurricanes. I'll talk to my Florida relatives, and we don't talk about Hurricane Wilma, but we talk about 9/11. I remember talking to one out-of-town person, and I said, "I think the people in the D.C. area had a hard time getting over this. It's almost as if the entire city went into a kind of post-traumatic stress." She said, "Well, you're never going to get over it."
Von Alex, I had this wild thing in my mind that everything that happened on September 11th was my fault, personally, that I could have changed it. I felt there was no place for me in the world. There were all these support groups, and I didn't belong there, because how do I sit in a room with people that are mourning and crying, and they're like, "What's your role in this whole thing?" Well, I checked in a couple of the hijackers and made sure they got on the flight. I might go weeks or months, and everything would go along fine. Then there'd be something that would trigger it, like checking in somebody who said, "My husband got killed on September 11th. What I heard was, "You killed my husband on September 11th. You don't really move past it."
Captain Jay Jonas. I got a phone call in about 2006 from somebody from headquarters. He said, "Is this Chief Jonas?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Are you working tonight? We have something we have to give to you." I said, "Can't you send it through the internal messengers?" He said, "No, this is something that has to be hand-delivered." The captain came to the firehouse, and he has this bag, and it was sealed and everything. And it was my face piece, the plastic face piece from my helmet. When you're issued a face piece, they etch your name into it. It was pulled off the debris field and put in this bag. It wasn't cleaned or anything. When I opened up the bag, it had the smell of the World Trade Center. It was like, "Oh, that's it," and closed it back up again.
Robert Small. For the first six anniversaries after 9/11, I was still employed with Morgan Stanley. Basically, the world would stop, and we would get together in the conference rooms and watch the ceremonies. I knew a New York fireman who had found a shard of glass from the site, and he gave it to me. I knew a construction worker who was helping clean up. He was a mechanic for the bulldozers, and he had a piece of rock that had got wedged in one of the rotation devices, so he kept it and said, "Here, you have it." I used to bring in my two little pieces on 9/11 and say, "This is part of it." We would watch it as a group together. Over the years, fewer people would come to watch. Then one year, I wanted to be home. And I watched it all on television.
I found out that MSNBC does a rebroadcast of the Today Show from that morning as it happened. I finally got to watch what everybody else got to watch, hearing what people thought was going on, what had hit the first tower, and then hearing them describe the jumpers and hearing them describe the aftermath. I was like, wow. I could see how hard it was for people on the outside.
In January 2011, the firefighters of Ladder 6 served as the pallbearers at the funeral of Josephine Harris, who had died at 69, nearly 10 years after all of them had been trapped together in Stairwell B. The survivors called Harris their guardian angel, believing that had they not stopped to rescue her, they would have been killed in the collapse. The interior of her coffin was custom embroidered with the image of a firefighter walking hand in hand with an angel.
Sal Cassano, now Commissioner FDNY. On a day that will always be recalled for its inconceivable devastation and unimaginable loss, the story of Josephine and the firefighters of Ladder 6 was nothing short of miraculous.
Jay Jonas, now a Deputy Chief, FDNY. You cannot say that something that happened to you is a miracle, but if she was not there for us to save, we probably would not have made it.
Peter DeLuca, owner, Greenwich Village Funeral Home. The six firefighters made the request that they be the ones who carried her in and out of church.
Jay Jonas, it was an honor to do this for her. We feel very happy that she is in God's hands.
Even as Harris was being laid to rest, the U.S. intelligence community was zeroing in on the man who launched the 9/11 plot. For nearly a decade, the CIA and U.S. government had continued to hunt for Osama bin Laden. Finally, they located a compound in Pakistan occupied by a mysterious tall figure who never ventured outside the high walls that surrounded the building.
Senior Chief Petty Officer Rob O'Neill, SEAL Team 6, U.S. Navy. We had a few weeks to prepare for the mission targeting Osama bin Laden. I was certain he was there in Abbottabad because of how the CIA analysts had explained how they found him. I was convinced, and the other guys were convinced that he was there too. We also were pretty sure that we weren't going to come back from the mission. We had this new stealth technology, but no one really knew if it worked. We didn't know how good the air defenses for Pakistan were. We knew that we were invading and that they could shoot us down and be justified. We also thought we might simply run out of gas in the helicopters and end up on foot in a really, really bad part of the world. We thought if anyone's going to blow himself up and his entire family and martyr everybody, it's going to be bin Laden. He wasn't going to let us get him. We went in there thinking this was a one-way mission. We had our last meals with our families and our kids. I know I did. And then hand-wrote letters to our families. We had to find people and say, hey, here's an envelope. If you don't see me tomorrow, you'll know what this is. And there are directions inside. But if you do see me tomorrow, give these back to me. People were saying to each other on the mission, if we know we're going to die, why are we going to go? Then we talked about the people who jumped out of the towers on a Tuesday morning. They didn't want to. They didn't know what was happening. All they knew was that it was 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, and the better alternative than whatever hell was going on inside, in Windows on the World or at Cantor Fitzgerald, was to jump. They were not supposed to be in the fight. We all joined to be in the fight. And that's why we were going. We had that conversation about how the first ones to fight Al-Qaeda were the passengers on Flight 93 that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. God knows how many lives they saved, but they killed themselves for the Western world. We had these conversations every night. That was why we went.
The terrorist leader behind the 9/11 plot was killed on May 2nd, 2011. As U.S. Navy SEALs raided the compound where he'd been hiding in Abbottabad, Pakistan. So that his grave site would never become a shrine, the Navy buried his body at sea. Barack Obama, President of the United States, May 2nd, 2011.
Good evening. Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It was nearly 10 years ago that a bright September day was darkened by the worst attack on the American people in our history. The images of 9/11 are seared into our national memory. Hijacked planes cutting through a cloudless September sky, the Twin Towers collapsing to the ground, black smoke billowing up from the Pentagon, the wreckage of Flight 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where the actions of heroic citizens saved even more heartbreak and destruction. And yet we know that the worst images are those that were unseen to the world. The empty seat at the dinner table, children who were forced to grow up without their mother or their father, parents who would never know the feeling of their child's embrace, nearly 3,000 citizens taken from us, leaving a gaping hole in our hearts. Today, at my direction, the United States launched a targeted operation against that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan. A small team of Americans carried out the operation with extraordinary courage and capability. No Americans were harmed. They took care to avoid civilian casualties. After a firefight, they killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body. The American people did not choose this fight. It came to our shores and started with the senseless slaughter of our citizens. After nearly 10 years of service, struggle, and sacrifice, we know well the costs of war. Yet, as a country, we will never tolerate our security being threatened, nor stand idly by when our people have been killed. We will be relentless in defense of our citizens and our friends and allies. We will be true to the values that make us who we are. And on nights like this one, we can say to those families who have lost loved ones to Al-Qaeda's terror, justice has been done.
Mike Morrell, Deputy Director, CIA. In 2011, the very first telephone call that President Obama made after we were sure we'd killed Osama bin Laden was to President Bush. President Obama knew that I'd been with him on 9/11, and so he asked me to fly down to Dallas after the raid to brief President Bush personally. I went down about 2 weeks later and walked President Bush through every aspect of the raid. I thought I could see in his face some sense of closure.
Sharon Miller. I look at the clock, and every time I look at the clock, it seems to be 9/11. I'm like, oh, 9/11, again. It just happens. Something so simple like that.
Linda Crooner. The sky in September can be particularly beautiful. When you look at a sky like it was on 9/11, you see it's that same clear blue sky. The light is very different than the light in the summer. I said, it's such a 9/11 sky.
Bruno Dellinger. If there is a beautiful day, I compare it to the morning of 9/11. Philip Smith. I actually kept my uniform. I've kept it in this bag since 9/11. You can see the stains on my shirt. That's the jet fuel from where the tank exploded and the debris in it. Army uniforms are surprisingly resilient because I was literally on fire from my head to my toe. This walked through the fires of the Pentagon and made its way out. I put it away and put it on the shelf. The Army goes rolling along and you keep moving.
Andrew Kurtzman, reporter, New York One. Life went on. The World Trade Center attacks were a horrendous catastrophe. But it's the nature of life that the next day people get up to go to work. Government officials do their jobs. Controversies erupt and life goes on. Life went on after Pearl Harbor. It's the nature of life.
Rosemary Dillard. I never called it an anniversary, because when I think of an anniversary, I think of a happy time. I think of an observance. a time mark.
Richard Eichen, consultant, past consulting group, North Tower, 90th floor. I go down to the ceremony each year, and I go down to the ceremony for the guy who died between my legs. It sounds odd, but if it was just me and what happened to me that day, I don't know if I'd come down. I survived. My story is ongoing.
Sheila Denise Moody. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I haven't thought about the events of September 11th.
Dan Nigro. We survive. We do our daily things. But you're always a part of 9/11.
Acknowledgements. The journey that grew into this book began in August 2016, a month before the 15th anniversary of the attacks, when I had the serendipity to sit at a Hoover Institution dinner in California next to Aaron Tillman. Two nights later, she introduced me to her husband, a.k.a. Colonel Mark Tillman, who loved my idea of reconstructing President Bush's travels on September 11th. And opened up the door to his crew on Air Force One so that I could write about being aboard the most famous plane in the world on one of its most historic flights. My friends Gordon Jonro and Ann Compton helped reconstruct who was on board the president's plane on 9/11. Andy Card helped me track down numerous Bush alumni, and Lieutenant Colonel Martin O'Donnell and Major Matt Miller helped me explore Offutt Air Force Base and later Barksdale. I'd like to thank my talented one-time colleagues at Politico Magazine, Steve Heuser, Elizabeth Ralph, and Bill Durier, for editing and publishing the original article on which this book is based, The Only Plane in the Sky, and to Steve, especially, for plucking the Ellen Eckert quote to become its title. From there, I want to give an extra special thanks to Politico's owner, Robert Albritton, its editor, John Harris, and its counsel, Kathy Hanna, for all believing in me and this project and letting it grow into this larger, expansive history. I'm grateful for your hard work, creativity, and friendship in helping me share this story. This project, even more than most books, which are never as solitary an exercise as many realize, has a literal cast of thousands to thank and acknowledge. Altogether, this book, while mine, stands as the collective product of 17 years of work by scores of oral historians, journalists, scholars, and officials who collected the stories of 9/11, many of whose names I know, others whose names I don't. I'm grateful to all of them, named and unnamed here. The National September 11 Memorial and Museum in New York was a deep supporter of this project throughout the 2 years it took to come to fruition. On my first day at the museum, Jess Chen led me through it and its heart-wrenching collection and exhibits. I will never forget turning around for the first time and seeing the crushed remnants of Ladder 3, nor standing in the galleries to listen to the victims' 911 calls and voicemails. Alice Greenwald, Amy Weinstein, and Jan Ramirez generously shared with me their knowledge and their archives, helping too to track down stray facts, voices, and make available every research request we could muster. Amy and Jan have built an unparalleled archival monument in their collection, an enduring gift for generations ahead. Amanda Granick helped nail down research details, and I'm grateful as well to Anthony Gardner, Alexandra Drakakis, Stephanie Schmeling, Bethany Romansky, and Michael Chu, as well as my friends Allison Blaze and Joe Daniels. Moreover, this work would not exist without the hard work over the years of those who helped transcribe, edit, and publish the 9/11 Museum's oral history collection, including Anna Altman, Meredith Davidson, Yasmin DaCosta, Louisa Diaz, Anna Dutzing, Jessica Evans, Caitlin Gamba, Elizabeth Gorski, Donna Kaz, Hillary Kirkham, Josh Levine, Winona Nelson, Catherine O'Donnell, Molly Sloan, and Katrina Weiser, among others. At the 9/11 Tribute Museum, I'm deeply grateful to then-curator Mary Lobel and her colleague Connor Gaudet, who together built and assembled their oral history collection, and CEO Jennifer Adams Webb, who saw the value of this project and supported it too, as well as the interns, volunteers, and others who worked on their collection. Even after she left the Tribute Museum, Mary helped edit drafts, correcting everything from street names to titles, and provided a thorough copy edit. At the Arlington County Public Library Oral History Project, their team included Heather Crosetto, Judith Knudsen, Joe B. Johnson, Diane Gates, and Bonnie Baldwin. At the Pentagon, the historians and interviewers involved in their effort to capture the building's story included Nancy Berlage, Rebecca Cameron, Alfred Goldberg, Richard Hunt, Diane Putney, Stuart Rochester, Roger Trask, and Rebecca Welsh. I'm thankful, too, for the work and help of Todd Harvey at the Library of Congress and Kathleen Johnson in the Historian's Office of the House of Representatives. At the Flight 93 National Memorial in Pennsylvania, I'm grateful to Bryn Bender, Barbara Black, Donna Glessner, and Kathy Schaefer, as well as their team of interns and volunteers who helped gather the stories of how their community was affected by the attack. Moreover, while many of these institutions had the good sense to capture the stories of 9/11 as soon as possible, their limited resources meant that many had never been transcribed. So Donna and Kathy spent months working with me to help transcribe dozens of oral histories that had been recorded but never put to paper. Donna read an early draft of the book deeply, providing pages and pages of thoughts, helping ensure the accuracy of the Flight 93 section, and suggesting additions to ensure the full sweep of the day was captured. Beyond the archives dedicated to these stories, I would be remiss not to recognize the massive contribution of other journalists and 9/11 historians who have researched this hallowed ground before me, above and beyond the formal citations and footnotes in the book. In the months immediately following the attacks, the husband and wife team of Mitchell Fink and Lois Mathias captured a wealth of important stories in their book Never Forget, some of which exist nowhere else. Jim Dwyer and Kevin Flynn's 102 Minutes, the unforgettable story of the fight to survive inside the Twin Towers, remains too an invaluable guide to the New York attacks. As Firefight, Inside the Battle to Save the Pentagon on 9/11 by Patrick Creed and Rick Newman does to the Pentagon. In the air, Cher Longman's Among the Heroes united Flight 93 and the passengers and crew who fought back, and Lynn Spencer's Touching History, the untold story of the drama that unfolded in the skies over America on 9/11. Both are critical guides to what transpired overhead, as are two fascinating aviation symposiums Spencer organized at the University of Texas at Dallas. Jessica Dulong's book, Dust to Deliverance, Untold Stories from the Maritime Evacuation on September 11th, mixes fascinating New York City maritime history with wrenching stories of the water evacuation from Lower Manhattan, as does Mike McGee's All Available Boats, The Evacuation of Manhattan Island on September 11, 2001. Two other books, Covering Catastrophe, Broadcast Journalists Report 9/11, compiled by Allison Gilbert, Phil Hirschkorn, Melinda Murphy, Mitchell Stevens, and Robin Walensky, as well as Running Toward Danger, Stories Behind the Breaking News of 9/11, compiled by two of my friends, Kathy Trost and Alicia Shepard, helped fill in how journalists responded to the unprecedented story. A talented team of Washington Post reporters, several of whom I've had the chance to know and all of whom I respect as writers, Monica Hess, Caitlin Gibson, Jessica Contrera, and Karen Heller, collected numerous stories of children on 9/11, which I've supplemented with my own to create the section here on being a child and at college that tragic day. The team at the Los Angeles Times collected dozens of stories on their Tumblr blog in 2011, which proved an invaluable time capsule in the depths of the internet. My then-agent Will Lippincott and lawyer Jamie Wolfe both helped make this story a reality, as did my new literary agent Howard Yoon and my talented team at UTA, Andrew Lear, Katrina Escudero, and Howie Sanders before his departure. My assistant Vanessa Sauter enthusiastically sorted through mounds of footnotes, names, and tracked down increasingly obscure queries to translate the project from a draft to a manuscript to a book. Jonathan Glickman and Adam Rosenberg at MGM instantly connected with this story. Liz Hanna was my partner for 2 days retracing Air Force One's travels on 9/11, walking the corridors and tarmac that President Bush traversed at Barksdale and Offutt, An experience that underscored in a way that words could never capture the fright and fear that would have been evident that day, even far from the sites of the attacks themselves. I owe the single deepest debt of this book to Jenny Pachucki, a talented oral historian who has devoted much of her career to understanding 9/11 and whose fingerprints are on almost every single page of this book. I was lucky enough to snap Jenny up from the National September 11th Museum, where she'd actually collected many of these stories herself, working with Amy and others, and knew many of these voices personally. For 2 years, Jenny was my guide through 9/11, helping me understand its nuances, the stories that needed to be captured, the voices, families, facts, legends, myths, and fictions that surround the day. She worked full-time for nearly a year, just gathering, reading, and sorting the oral histories collected in this book, as well as many more that ultimately didn't make it. Jenny was my intellectual partner on the project at every step. I'm indubitably indebted to her in ways big and small for parrying hundreds of my questions by phone, email, and text at all hours and days of the week, her travel up and down the East Coast to access archives large and small, and her work organizing more than 10,000 pages of research through countless memos and spreadsheets, as well as her work tracking down numerous photos. This book would literally not exist without her help and the decade of hard work and knowledge she brought to the project. Jenny, I never could have navigated this without you, and I'm thankful for your ongoing, lasting friendship. I hope I've done your life's work proud. As I've been writing this book, I've said it was surely the most interesting and challenging puzzle I'll ever tackle. Assembling the myriad pieces and voices from that day into the portrait here was unquestionably the hardest and most emotional writing endeavor I've ever undertaken. This was my second book painstakingly edited by Jofi Ferrari Adler and Juliana Hobner, and I hope never to write another book without them. As long as the book is now, the first draft started at literally twice the length, and Jenny, Jofi, and Juliana worked for months to help shape, organize, and narrow it across ultimately 7 drafts, some of which Juliana devotedly diagrammed like Carrie Matheson pursuing a new plot. The 4 of us had deep, thoughtful, and challenging conversations about the level of editing we could do to the voices here. We tried at every turn to balance personal style and authenticity with recognizing that spoken speech is often arduous to translate into written speech, and ensuring that we captured people saying what they meant to say as they recalled high-stress, traumatic experiences. Jonathan Evans and Judith Hoover did yeoman's work helping to scrub the manuscript and copy editing. Ultimately, of course, all the editorial decisions and remaining mistakes are mine alone. More broadly, there's a long list of people who have been critical to me being who and where I am today. Among them, Charlotte Stochek, Mary Creedon, Mike Baginski, Rome Asia, Karen McCadden, and Charlie Phillips. John Rosenberg, Richard Medeiros, Brian DeLay, Peter J. Gomes, Stephen Shoemaker, and Jennifer Axum. Kit Seeley, Pat Leahy, Rusty Greif, Tim Seldes, Jessica Salke, Paul Eli, Tom Friedman, Jack Limpert, Jeff Chandler, Susan Glasser, and not least of all, Cousin Connie, to whom I owe a debt that I strive to repay every day. My parents, Chris and Nancy Price Graff, have encouraged me to write since an early age, instilling in me a love of history and research and an intellectual curiosity that benefits me daily. And my sister Lindsay has always been my biggest fan, and I hers. At home, I had the good-natured help of Sam Hubachek, the second best addition to our family of the last year. My wife, Catherine, provided bottomless support and listened, as all writer spouses are doomed to do, as I talked in wonder about this project and worked obsessively on it at odd hours during a particularly busy and transformative time. Thank you, KB. Most of all, though, I'm grateful to each and every survivor and participant of 9/11 who shared their stories with me, other historians or journalists, or simply wrote down their memories for posterity, including those featured here, those whose stories I didn't have the opportunity to include, and those stories I've never even heard. There are millions of memories of that day, each unique, trying, and historic in its own way. I was surprised and heartened by the collective willingness to share and relive that trauma. Everyone I sought to interview over 2 years jumped to participate, even as a stranger contacted them out of the blue and asked them to discuss, in depth and at length, the worst day of their lives. Even reading the stories recorded by others often felt at times overwhelmingly heartrending and intimate. I cannot fathom the pain, physical or emotional, many of you experienced that day and after. I cried almost every single day as I compiled the first draft of this book and read or listened as you all recounted living through America's most dread-filled day. Together, your strength is a testament and inspiration to the resiliency of the human spirit, and I'm appreciative of your desire to help ensure that future generations understand what happened on September 11th. We must never forget. Garrett Graff, Burlington, Vermont, May 2019.
The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11, was written by Garrett M. Graff. It was narrated by Holter Graham, with the introduction and acknowledgments read by the author. The full cast included Fager Alkazi, Fred Berman, Jeremy Bobb, Will Brill, Teddy Kanyes, Jeremy Davidson, Ari Fliakos, James Foey, Adam Grouper, January Lavoie, Jennifer Lim, Therese Blummer, Jacques Roy, David Sadson, Suzanne Torin, Neela Vaswani, and Ben Williams. With Andy Card, Ann Compton, and Colonel Mark Tillman. Additional voices: Juan Ayala, Mike Beato, Arthur Bishop, Fausto Boza, Steve Breslin, Anna Chan, John Crow, John Evans, Terry Hogan, John Paul Jones, Sean Kerwin, Allison Light, Ben Lunan, Chris Lynch, Al Maddox, Michael Noble, Paul O'Halloran, Brian Ramcharan, Frank Schaefer, and Kevin Wakely. This program includes archival audio from United States presidential addresses, in-flight communications, and air traffic control. The Only Plane in the Sky was recorded by Kathleen Conti and Catherine Cook at CDM Sound Studios in New York City, Joseph Egan at Egan Media in Vermont, Nick Feinbarg at Costa Mesa Recording Studios in California, John St. Denis at Magic Lantern in Atlanta, Corey Marcello at Clean Cuts in Washington, D.C., Daniel Jameson at Endless Recording Studios in Mason, New Hampshire, and Terry Hogan and Brian Ramcharan at Simon & Schuster in New York City. Post-production, mix, and master by Danny Meltzer. Additional editing by Jake Nomura-Weingrow and Wesley Swinnen. The associate producers were Allison Light and Claire Tadakoro. Tara Thomas was the script supervisor. Brian Ramcharan was the managing producer. Special thanks to Donna Glessner, Allison Koch, Miriam Lobel, and Jenny Pachuki. The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11, was produced and directed by Scott Sherrod. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11, is available in print from Avid Reader Press. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Raven Rock, written by Garrett M. Graff and read by Jacques Roy.
Hi, I'm Garrett Graff, author of The Only Plane in the Sky, and I'm here with one of the narrators of the audiobook, Holter Graham. Holter, it's great to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Garrett. Hello, yes, my name is Holter Graham, and I'm narrated predominantly the interstitial, the information pieces between what people said to each other. It was an honor to do so, and I appreciate the opportunity. I don't know if inspiration is the right word. I mean, this to me is my generation's either Kennedy or the Space Shuttle Challenger, so it obviously is an important thing. But what drew you to the project?
Great question. And I think that for me, I had written a piece in 2016 for the 15th anniversary of 9/11 that was actually entitled We're the Only Plane in the Sky, which was an oral history of being aboard Air Force One with President Bush on 9/11. And I went out and spoke to about 28 of the people who were in Air Force One, around Air Force One that day, from the fighter pilot who was following him to the pilot of Air Force One to White House Chief of Staff Andy Card and a whole bunch of others. And that piece published in Politico magazine September 2016, and I was just overwhelmed by the reaction to the story. Just within a couple of days, it became the most read story in the history of Politico, and I got first dozens, then scores, then ultimately hundreds of letters and emails and tweets from readers about their own 9/11 experience and what that story meant to them. And there were two responses that really stood out for me. The first was a letter from a woman veteran who had served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who had said that she had two young children, I think they were 7 and 9 at the time, and that she had printed out the article about Air Force One as a way to someday, when her children were old enough to read it, to help explain to them why mommy went off to war. And the second was also a reaction from another veteran. This was a younger guy, Army veteran, who had done 3 tours, 2 in Afghanistan, 1 in Iraq. And he had just been in middle school when 9/11 happened. And he wrote in to say that the piece for him was the first time that he had ever really understood the trauma that the nation went through on 9/11. And those are two reactions really just stuck with me as I sort of thought through, you know, what must it be like to have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan without really understanding 9/11, without really having strong memories of what it meant for the country. And now we're seeing, obviously, this new generation come in. This fall marks the first college class born after 9/11. You're seeing the first soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen born after 9/11 beginning to deploy to the wars that that day launched. And you're seeing actually this year the first firefighters in New York City start to apply to the department who have no memory of the day that 343 of their firefighter colleagues died in the World Trade Center. So that sort of shift of the country as 9/11 moves from memory into history was what inspired me to turn that original piece into a full book and to think about trying to capture the whole national experience of that day. And the goal with the book really is not necessarily to tell the facts of 9/11, because many of us sort of know the facts, and you have seen organizations like the 9/11 Commission spend millions of dollars and years of effort sort of gathering the precise tick-tock of the day. And I think what we're losing as a country is what it was like to experience that day. And so that was the goal for the book. And Holter, sort of in that vein, I was curious, because one of the reasons that I know you ended up as part of this project was because of your own experience on 9/11 and the days and weeks after. And yeah. I'd love for you to just tell that story and to share your own memories of 9/11.
Yeah, I'll try to make it brief. As I said, it's sort of the where were you when for my generation, especially for people who lived in New York. There's a shorthand, you know, were you there? Yeah. Did you go to the pile? Yeah. or no, or, you know, I couldn't make it. So my wife, who also narrates some of the voices in the book, we lived on 16th Street between 7th and 8th, just two blocks above what they eventually, you know, shut down as the danger zone at 14th Street. I was walking my dog, Lugnut, that morning down 7th Avenue when the first plane went over. I distinctly remember thinking that, oh, look, there's some rich jerk with a Learjet showing off to some girl by buzzing the city. And so I had my regular New York, you know, cynical, angsty response. Turned the corner, went home, heard workmen on our roof yelling. Again, who would have thought they were yelling at something like what actually happened? So what are they arguing about at this early in the morning? Got upstairs and, as a news junkie, turned on the local news station, New York One, and then saw what happened. My wife was in the back of the apartment when I said, you know, you have to, oh my God. And because she is half Indian, half American, and traveled the world with her teacher, mother, and doctor father when she was younger, spent time traveling to Israel, when she came out, the second she looked at the TV, she said to herself, that's a terrorist attack. And I thought, wow, a plane crashed into a building, that's insane. And I didn't have it solidify in my gut until, while Pat Kiernan, the newscaster, was speaking and not apparently looking at his monitor, during a sentence he said, the second plane hooked that deadly left, went into the second tower. And at that point, all of a sudden, the lead weight in your soul says, no, this was on purpose. So that was our first moment. And then, like I think a lot of New Yorkers, we basically watched TV for hours and hours. And we unrolled our you know, hide-a-bed, which was in the television room, and just lay there and watched TV until I think we fell asleep. My wife, who has kind of generous soul that would knock people over, couldn't really not do anything, and so got up the next morning. Chelsea Piers is straight further west of us, and that had become sort of a de facto triage site because it has a lot of open spaces, and that's where all of the ambulances that were flooding in from really all over the right half of the country were parked in a long line. So she went there and she was wrangled by someone from FEMA. And so she took missing persons information for FEMA for the entirety of that day. She took hundreds and hundreds of names. And for the years that every 9/11, they said all the names at the ceremony, she always would sort of murmur, oh, I remember her. Her husband was so worried. That person brought in a hairbrush, hoping that maybe the DNA and the hair would be helpful. She was very traumatized by it and remembered it with an excruciating clarity. And I went over a little later and was sort of going back and forth doing grunt work. I was on rollerblades and I went to get a couple of reams of copy paper because everything was just so thrown together back, you know, in Chelsea, and then came back and was doing sort of whatever work I could. Later that night, we hitched a ride because at that point everything was ad hoc. Completely just, it wasn't even really a volunteer or not. If you had to do something, you did it. We got in a Vanagon, you know, an old hippie van, quote unquote, that was almost full with sheets of raspberry tart to take down there with two people who had the Vanagon, and we just kind of piled in the back, got dropped off at the corner of Trinity, the southwestern corner of Trinity Church's graveyard. And that's when I looked down at my boots and saw that they were covered in this ashy, white, silty paste. And there were, you know, paper strewn everywhere up against the headstones and up against the wrought iron of the fence. And so we went down to see what we could do, and everything was kind of muddled. And here, you can help these people or not. And we hung around for a while. Now, we didn't hand anything out because there wasn't anyone to receive the food yet. There wasn't enough organization. So we dropped it all off in, I think, part of Trinity Church in a room that was already piled high with food that I now realize no one ever ate. I remember distinctly with my wife looking up at the Marriott and thinking it really looked like it was tilting. Apparently it wasn't because it's still there. But the way everything was so broken down there, the way that everything visually was so wrong, it was easy to look up at this tall black building and think, this thing's leaning toward me. It could go at any moment. So that was our first night. And then we came back either the next day or the day after. It's a little bit hard in looking back. And this time with the Red Cross. The Red Cross was doing a much more organized job of handing out water and water bottles and food and like small edible packets to the, at the time, still rescue workers. And we did that on and off for that day. And then Friday, a very good friend of ours who went to college with us, who is Iranian-American, was reached out to by a group of Iranian businessmen in Los Angeles. And they said to him, is there anything we can do to help you? And he said, well, my friend Holter has a pickup truck, so why don't you guys just somehow get us some money and we're going to get supplies and we'll go help. And we went back to Chelsea Piers and found people who had been doing it and official people, Red Cross people, and said, what do you guys actually need on site? Because we knew food wasn't really helping. It was already way too much food. It was beginning to rot. And they said, water's taken care of too. And they gave us a very specific list of tarps, work gloves, and most importantly, the respirator replacements for face masks, so that people had been breathing in whatever they were breathing in, and they had fouled their original respirators on the front of the face masks. So we went to the Home Depot in Brooklyn, and we bought a little over $6,000 worth of stuff on an Iranian-American gold card number, and bought some red duct tape and taped red crosses on either side of my white pickup truck, and drove back. And the fastest way to get where we were going from Brooklyn to the pile was to go through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, which had been closed. And by this time, it's Friday, the military had taken over. It's now a military site. So we get to the toll booth, and there's a nice young man with probably, I don't know, an M14, full-blown machine gun. He's in full garb, black jacket, helmet, the whole thing, and he puts his hand up. And as we slow down, and I'd start to sort of say, we were just sent to buy some lovely people in Los Angeles to buy this stuff. He didn't let me get any further than that because he saw what was filling the back of the truck, and he just waved us through. And so we had the extremely surreal experience of flooring it through a completely empty Brooklyn Battery Tunnel and then popping out basically at ground zero on the other end. And there were checkpoints of other nice people, men and women with guns, about every block. And they just kept looking at the truck and saying, go forward, look at the truck, go forward. And that happened about four times. And then somebody said, okay, park, you're close enough. You can unload your stuff and go give it to people. And it wasn't until a few weeks ago when I was back downtown for a completely different reason and I realized that we had parked in Zuccotti Park, the whole Occupy Wall Street place, which is right there. And then we got out and we just started doing runs from the back of the truck over toward the pile. We were on the south end of the pile at that point and just handing things out. We each had like a cardboard box and it had some respirators in it and some gloves. And I think we got eyewash, whatever they had at the Home Depot. And I remember how good people had become at recognizing the respirators for their masks. They would start sifting through our box and just tossing things aside and saying, oh, there's mine. And then they'd walk off. And we did that until the truck was empty, and then we went home and didn't go back to the pile at that point. So that was the actual 9/11 event. And to this day and forevermore, we will not know if it caused it, but in 2010, in April, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And in the intake interview with our doctors at New York Presbyterian, my wife said, you know, could it possibly have a 9/11 connection? The Mount Sinai medical system was already up taking care of people, and so that was in the air, we knew to ask. And my oncologist, Dr. Feldman, said, there's no way to ever tell you, there's no way to ever be sure. However, the gestation for this particular kind of leukemia is 8 to 9 years. And this was early 2010. So who knows? We did get put on the Mount Sinai list. My wife did too. She had very bad GERD from breathing all those months in Chelsea as the pile smoldered for however many months it did. And I'm a union member, Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, the short version is SAG-AFTRA. And I'm very active in union leadership. And I stood next to Kirsten Gillibrand at a couple of different rallies to get what became the Zadroga Act first created and then enacted and then a couple of years later, you know, made more long-term. So I saw it from sort of that side too, that the people who went down there with utter disregard for their own health to try and help, and even when it became clear that this was recovery and not rescue, and even when it became clear that it wasn't even recovery anymore, it was just a job, the place was flooded with people always like, what can I do? Where do I go? Many of them, FDNY, Port Authority, and police. it's important that those people, that thank you, not just be a thank you. It'd be a, we'll take care of you for sticking your neck out. So it's an enormous part of my life.
That's an incredible story, and I have to say, sir, one of the most unexpected, to me, bits of working on this book over these last, what's now been about 3 years, has been the stories that I have heard from friends and colleagues and people that I've known for a long time that I just had no idea the way that 9/11 had impacted or changed or affected their lives. It's really amazing to me how, and I talk about this in the book's introduction, really, how we all just have such a need, viscerally almost, to tell our own story and to share our experiences that day. And you and your wife obviously have a much more intensely personal one than many. And it's incredible how many lives that the events of that day touched, and like yours, really fundamentally reshaped in major ways for years, or at this point, even decades ahead.
Absolutely. If you don't mind, where were you?
I have what is ultimately a relatively boring 9/11 story. Certainly,
that's in kind comparison, of a blessing.
Yeah, and certainly in comparison to you, I was in college. I was in my dining hall eating breakfast. Even sort of as basic and quotidian as that is, I have such a strong memory of that first moment. I remember my friend coming in saying that two planes had hit the World Trade Center. I could walk back into that dining room today and walk directly to the seat that I was sitting in. I could tell you everyone who was seated around that table that day. You know, I could tell you exactly how my friend rested her hand on the table at the moment that she was talking about it. Then just over the course of the rest of the day, you know, I went back to my dorm and then ran down to the college newspaper where I worked. I remember exactly where I was standing when I realized that the first tower had fallen. I remember exactly where I was standing when I saw Osama bin Laden's picture on the TV for the first time that day. Mm-hmm. And I just remember sort of being so puzzled about how could everyone who was on TV be so sure that this was the person who had attacked us?
Right.
Because I had never heard of him. I had never heard of this Al-Qaeda group. Yet sort of everyone on TV was talking about it as if this was the only obvious answer. And of course, I've spent almost the entire time of my professional career since then writing about the after effects of 9/11, you know, covering the FBI and the intelligence community and the rise of DHS and the Department of Homeland Security. And almost all of my writing in some ways is an unintentional outgrowth of the questions of sort of what 9/11 has wrought in our modern world ever since. Tell me a little bit about what it was like recording the audiobook and being involved in the project and your wife, and given the background that you two brought to this, what did that mean in terms of the recording?
The director sort of mentioned something to me in passing as we saw each other, you know, at a different day on a different job. But we were basically approached at the same time. The first thing you do is you both look at each other and heave a really heavy sigh. I'm just kind of like, right, that, you know, it's not the elephant in the room. It's the burning building that's killing people in the room. And, you know, we're never that far from it. But at the same time, if you're given the opportunity to memorialize or to honor that event and the people who lost their lives and the people whose lives began in a completely different way that day, you want to be involved. My wife and I had slightly different experiences because I was doing predominantly narrating, which is not to say that there's not incredibly powerful sections of narration and that I did not go through, you know, almost every emotion in the book working. But she had, you know, actual sort of human voices. This woman said this, this woman said that. And so we were kind of in different places of the same importantly unpleasant experience. And she's got a work ethic and so do I. So underneath all of that, you want to do your job well, both because you want to honor the process and the book and what the book's about, but just because it's your job, you want to do it well. So it was very multifaceted. And of course, you did all the research. You laid out this, as you refer to, sort of the TikTok of the whole thing, but through the humanist version. So there's all these moments that I didn't know about, or maybe some of the recordings I hadn't heard or known existed, but specific. The two things that stand out to me most the first firefighter to lose his life, correct me if I'm wrong, lost it because someone who was falling out of the tower landed on it.
Yeah.
That's insane, and at the same time, it's perfect for what happened that day. That level of surreality is exactly what happened to the world that day. And the second was, I think it's flight 175, it might have been flight 93, that a 2.5-year-old girl named Christine was the youngest victim.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two nuggets that I didn't know, in one sense, were perfect. We're exactly just more of that story, that level of horror. But they sort of tacked it down for me in a new way that was outside of my experience of what happened.
So Christine, who was 2.5 on 9/11, you mentioned her as the youngest victim, and she was killed with her parents on Flight 175, Peter Hansen and Soo Kim. They were on their way to Disney, actually, that day for vacation. She would be 20 years old now. She would be a college student if she hadn't been on that plane that day. It's sort of incredible to think of the passage of time and sort of how it has, what it has meant for all of those families that have been impacted. And then as we remember it, as you sort of think about and these moments where these things that had so much meaning at the time, now you have sort of generations walking by who don't really necessarily understand the import.
Do you have a moment from your research that stands out?
This sounds like an incredibly dumb, naive comment, but I was really unprepared for how emotional this book would be to research and write. When I was doing particularly the first draft, you know, I was reading maybe a half dozen or a dozen oral histories a day, and there was probably not a day in the drafting that I didn't end up crying at some point. And there are sort of still parts of the book that I can't talk about without getting choked up. But sort of a couple of points really do stand out for me and sort of stories in it. Charles Kristoff, who was in an office near the World Trade Center, and his wife ended up dying in the towers that day. He had had a new daughter. I still can't talk about this part. And he, you know, sort of picked her up from daycare at the end of the day after escaping Manhattan himself. You know, brand new baby, had no idea that something was amiss. Sort of the story that he had, you know, beginning to think about raising his daughter as a single parent that day, yeah, really took me back over the course of that, in part because my wife and I had actually had a daughter in the midst of writing this book, and I wrote a lot of the book, drafted a lot of the book early on with her sleeping on the floor next to me. That's ultimately who I dedicated the book to, and all of the children affected by 9/11. But just sort of thinking about that human relationship, you know, parent to child, and you see it in The Only Plane in the Sky in both directions. You know, we follow parents who lost children, children who lost parents, and then parents who lost spouses, as well as the myriad other ways that that day unfolded, of spouses being concerned for each other, siblings rescuing each other or losing siblings. It's just sort of all of that human emotion that gets overlaid in this book to what we have lived for the last 20 years as really a geopolitical story. That to me was sort of part of the importance of doing this book, was to remember where all of this began and why this began. Because you now have, as I said, people going off to fight in these wars who were not even born on that day of 9/11. It's just incredible to me to sort of think through just how far removed we are today, and yet how much of our whole world is still shaped by the events of 9/11.
Yeah, absolutely.
Holter, it's been great talking with you, and thank you for volunteering after 9/11, and thank you for being part of what I hope is a very special project to turn this book into audio voices.
I believe it will, and thank you very much for doing the work and taking the time and putting yourself through what you had to go through to do the job right. It's been an honor to work on it, and it's been good to talk to you about it today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.